Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Oh, the Premier League and domestic club football briefly interrupted this World Cup bliss for me today. Three different things. Lloris Karius's video, his, I don't know what you'd call it, Insta fabulous video from Hollywood.
He looked very cool, and like his life is just way better than ours.
Yeah, and certainly he's not.
It felt a little Julian Lescott to me. Maybe that's unfair, because Lescott actually like blatantly said, you know, my life rules. It's not so bad. Karius didn't actually do that, but I don't know.
I think he left us in little doubt as to he's doing fine.
Message.
Don't worry about me.
That's all right. I don't want him to have a bad life.
No. Then Cronaldo and his jiggery pokery involving Juventus, and is he going, is he not going? And then boy wonder rumors.
Yeah, I'll address that a little bit later.
Okay, but I'm just saying, this is all, it's all either irritating or speculation, and it just intruded and made me realize about the gaping hole, chasm. I don't want to go back to the drudgery. I want this to be the eternal World Cup.
Yeah, I know. It's been that fun. But look at the things you just mentioned. The Pulisic thing, you know, an American guy. Like, it's all things from countries whose World Cup is over.
Yeah.
So they're going back to the soccer that they care about. Not to say that they don't care about the World Cup, but you know what I mean.
It's like we're in
life goes on.
We're in like some kind of wonderful dreamland right now where it's just great football and great stories. And I never want it to end.
You just don't want to wake up. Don't wake me up when it's all over, a man once said.
I don't want to close my eyes. I don't want to fall asleep because I'd miss it, baby. And I don't want to miss a thing.
Aerosmith. What a show we have coming up. And a guest coming up in a little bit that I'm very excited about. A guy who you've referenced countless times on this show, former goalkeeper, now he's a journalist over in England, David Preece. I've heard him many times on the Totally Football show.
Yep, he's great, experienced footballer, been all over the place, knows his goalkeeping inside out.
Yeah, so very excited to talk to him. We've got a big mailbag because we did not have one the other day.
Oh, it's enormous.
Red card man of the match, doubling up these weeks with red card man of the match. And you know what? There's been no shortage. It hasn't really been hard to find them.
It hasn't either. I would like to thank people for, we've had a great response to our quarterfinal iTunes reviews. So
nice.
Keep them coming, which we're going to read on Tuesday of next week, I believe, on the next pod anyway.
Yeah.
So we'll have all of those, some moments I'd forgotten about, some really great moments.
Oh. And you were worried. You had said to me last time, you were like,
specific.
Shouldn't we just make it more general with your World Cup? And I said, no. The people will handle it fine. It's a smart audience that we have, and they'll find the memories, and they have.
So get involved, leave an iTunes review, and in the iTunes review, leave your favorite World Cup quarterfinal moment, and it may get read on the podcast.
So here we go. It's the quarterfinals, as you just said. So we thought there were a couple ways we could attack this. We could just go through game by game, which is a thing that we often do, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I feel like we've been doing a lot of that kind of, so we got something a little bit different on this podcast today. For the quarterfinals, we got eight teams left, and so along with that comes eight questions that we will throw out there and thusly answer.
Thusly.
Mm-hmm. Ready for the first one?
Yes, sir.
JJ, of these matchups in the quarterfinals, which one are you most looking forward to?
Obviously, outside of perfidious Albion versus IKEA, which is England versus Sweden, Belgium versus Brazil.
Yeah, that's the one I picked as well.
Apart from anything else, Brazil are looking to snap a European hoodoo. They've been knocked out by France, Netherlands and Germany in the last three World Cups. And that's fascinating to me. So there'll be a little bit of trepidation going into that one against a loaded Belgian side.
It's also fascinating because, you're right, that's recent history, but it's not Brazil's history. They're actually 43-15-15 all-time against European teams.
Yeah, but there's a worrying trend that culminated in that awful day in the Maracanã when they were just absolutely smashed by Germany. So they're you know, it's that'll be on their mind to put
you
things
think it
right.
Will?
Well, if you look at who they've played so far, Brazil would think nothing of Serbia. Brazil would think nothing of Costa Rica. Brazil drew with Switzerland, which was a little bit of a blip on the radar. And Mexico, they would have been expected to beat.
Right.
This is the first massive juggernaut of a European side that they're going to meet. And while they will be uber confident, as is their wont, there will be a little bit of thoughts in the background. Now, Brazil seem to be getting better as the tournament rolls on, whereas the perception of Belgium has probably changed a little bit since the Japanese game. They have a few more questions now to be highlighted. But this is Brazil without Casemiro. it's a Brazil that's going to have to rejig a few things. I suppose Fernandinho comes in and he should do a fine job. Belgium have questions over that left-hand side. I won't say it's a total rebuild for Belgium, but there's going to be some guys who are going to miss out after what happened against Japan.
Yeah, you would think. By the way, for Brazil, it's worth mentioning that Danilo has been ruled out for the remainder of the tournament. He's been hurt, and they've said he's not coming back.
So it's going to be riding with the two full backs that they have right now.
Yeah,
so.
But I'll say this, though. If you're Brazil, I would think, I know Belgium did win, but I think Brazil have got to be licking their chops a little bit, seeing how open Belgium allowed Japan to play. I think that would suit Brazil.
But, and don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. I am not for one moment suggesting that that Japan are a better side than Brazil.
But thank you for not suggesting that.
Well, the point being is that if Brazil up their speed of play again, and it's been the key phrase for me in this tournament, when the good sides, including Belgium, turn it on, pass and move the ball quickly, they will be very, very difficult. But a lot's going to, you know, hinge on Neymar. At the other end, a lot's going to, you know, hinge on Hazard. Big thing for me is if Martinez goes three at the back again, what three does he go with? Does he take company out again? Axel Witsel has to be better than he was the last time.
He's been playing ahead of Moussa Dembele, who you know what I think of.
Right, but his role in that side is twofold. It's definitely getting them on the front foot, but it's also screening into the fullback positions when they don't have the ball.
Well, I think they believe he's a more defensive-minded player.
He is.
But if he's not doing that job,
right,
then what good is he?
What's the point? Or do you play, maybe do you play two there? Do they go to four at the back? Would that be something they do? What about Carrasco?
Well,
as a left wing-back, Andrew, it's not working out.
No, and there has to be more cover for him. If he's going to be the guy on that side,
someone's got to slide across.
Yeah, I mean,
you can't leave Vertonghen exposed
again. And that's why you start, I mean, you talked about how Brazil have gotten better with each game, and you start thinking about these defensive shortcomings that Belgium have, and you start thinking about the way that Willian and Neymar and Coutinho have looked over the last couple games. Coutinho really throughout. Neymar too, for that matter.
The attack, now, I'm hearing rumors that Mertens might be dropped. I would not do that. The attack of Belgium has to occupy those fullbacks for Brazil. Has to keep them going the other way. Because if they're charging into the gaps on the assumption that Belgium are playing three at the back, that's a problem. It's a fascinating tie. Absolutely fascinating.
That's why I picked it. It was the answer to both of us for that question. The next question now, of all the remaining players in this tournament, who would you most want on your team?
I'm a rule breaker, Andrew.
What does that mean? I'm curious.
It means because you always get angry with me because I can't give a straight answer, so I've picked three players.
I love it, though.
Harry Kane.
Okay.
Out-and-out goal scorer, absolute calm and stealth from the penalty spot. That's absolutely huge, especially at this point in the tournament. Eden Hazard for Belgium, who is just such a creative force, and I just love watching him. Even in that Japanese game where not everything went their way, I still thought he was fabulous at times. And Godin, who is proving himself to be one of the preeminent centre-half in the world right now.
Interesting. I kind of approach this question a little differently than you.
You just picked one player.
Well, yes, I did. But also, not in the way that you did, whereas if I had to win a game today, who from this tournament? I was kind of thinking, like, if I was building a team, who would I start with?
All right.
You did fine. Hey, you did fine.
Condescend to me, Andrew. It's wonderful.
So with that in mind, I went with Kylian Mbappe because in watching him play in this tournament and in hearing the praise from people who I generally respect of things that are being said about him, where people are already, you know, maybe it's premature to be talking about him as being the guy who will carry the mantle from Ronaldo and Messi when they start to hit that decline in their careers. But I'm buying it. But I really am buying the hype. Because everything we've seen with him at Monaco, PSG, and now he's doing it internationally with France, pressure does not seem to have any effect on this guy. He seems to rise in it. 19 years old. He's 19, and he's looked like the best player on a team that is loaded with superstar talent. So I think he would be it for me. Your answers were all good, and you've certainly made me look bad among my fellow Spurs fans by you picking Harry Kane and me not.
No, that wasn't my intention, but I just saw him the other night, and when the needful needed to be done, he was well capable of it on two separate occasions. He is not a brittle center forward. His confidence is through the roof.
You know what I love about Mbappe also? And it kind of was summarized in their win against Argentina. He's capable, I feel like, even at this young age, of scoring every type of goal. Like, he has the speed to break through. He didn't score a goal on it, but he draws the penalty just with his pure speed on Marcus Rojo. But then, the goal, he can score beautiful goals, but then, like, he's capable of the scrappy goal. That one where it was just kind of like a scramble in front. He finds one crease in the defense, gets around, and then just blasts a shot on net from close range that goes through the keeper.
His feet are so quick. He's not one of those speedsters. Like, there was always that thing about certain strikers, Michael Owen in particular, and I know Michael Owen was a good finisher, but the ball over the top. But when Michael Owen's speed started to wane, he really couldn't do the things he used to be able to do. Whereas I feel there's so many strings to this guy's bow.
Absolutely. So he would be my answer to that question. And now the next question. Which matchup has the biggest blowout potential? Can I answer this one first? Because we did kind of already talk about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I almost can't believe I'm saying this. I think so highly of Belgium, but for many of the reasons that you said before about Belgium's defense and the questions we have, that is the one that I would pick. And part of it is by default. Like, I think there's more of a chance Brazil win that 3-0 than almost any of the other games end 3-0. Uruguay, it's just hard for me to envision their defense playing in a way that would allow something like that to happen, even with the firepower that France do have. Sweden, the same. I think they're just so disciplined, compact defensively. They're going to just drag the game out against England. I know England did it to Panama, but that's insulting to even put Sweden in that category. I don't think you can look at the two styles and draw any comparisons other than the fact that Sweden are going to try to slow the game down like Panama would have. And then same for Russia. Again, what they did to Spain. Let's put 10 guys behind the ball and make Croatia just find a way. It's not going to be easy. Belgium is the only one where if Brazil are on their day and Belgium – and defensively Brazil have conceded just one goal in this tournament.
Right.
That's the game where I just feel like it could get away – it could just get away from Belgium if they're not careful defensively, which at times in this tournament they haven't been. Japan, you can get away with it. Barely. They came back.
Barely.
But Brazil, if you make those kind of mistakes, I don't know. So I could – if. I don't. It's not my prediction. I'm not predicting 3-0 or 4-0 Brazil. But if I had to choose any of these that would be a blowout, it would be that one.
I've gone a different route. I don't see it. I think most of the ties are very evenly matched, and I take your point on Belgium and Brazil.
Yeah.
But I think if Russia emerge from behind their defensive wall even a slight bit, I think Croatia will pick them off and the counter-attack very, very efficiently with the midfield that they have and the players that they have. I actually think Russia may have grown in confidence a little bit, and I think they'll come out and play a tiny little bit more than they did because they'll have a little bit more of the a lot more of the ball than they had against Spain, and that could lure them into something where Rakitic, Modric, Rebic and Mandzukic can break on them.
You're right, but Croatia, with some of those guys, especially in the midfield that you just said, like Modric and Rakitic specifically, they'll play a possession-based game.
No, I hear...
Not quite to the level that Spain will.
No, they won't do it to that level.
You could be looking at another 70-30 possession breakdown. I mean, Croatia are going to see a ton of the ball in this.
I still think so, but I think Russia are going to look at them and say, well, you know, we're here now. We're in a quarterfinal. I don't expect them not to play with two backs of four, but I do think... It's weird for me to say it, but the evidence is there. I think Croatia will be much more efficient when they get the ball off on the counter-attack against Russia. There will be a period where Russia will get forward and they'll lose the ball. The attack will break down. That's when I see Croatia possibly capitalizing.
Which matchup has the biggest upset potential?
Is Uruguay an upset?
Well, that's the one that I picked too.
If they beat France without Cavani?
I think even with Cavani, it will still be considered an upset. I mean, France are the favored side.
Right.
With or without Cavani. Yeah, if Uruguay don't have Cavani and they win, of course, it's certainly an upset.
I think if Russia turn over Croatia, that's another upset, let's be honest.
Yeah, the Uruguay one is the one that I pointed out also. I don't know, I think Uruguay took some heat early in this tournament because they weren't playing the way that we wanted them to.
No.
And like a lot of other games had been.
It's just so naive.
Of course it is.
It's so
And it's so selfish.
But it's people like us who read and create the previews for World Cups and look at teams and look at them just on paper, on the dry stats and on some of the stuff from qualifying. Because let's be honest, we don't see that much of Uruguay tournament to tournament.
I watch every single game.
And we just want, because we see Cavani, because we see Suarez, we want them to be better. We want them to be more expansive. That's not the way they play. It's never been the way they play.
But I think they could do it.
I think they can too. I really think they can too. Although, when you look at the body of work that Cavani put in into the game, I mean, look at his running stats alone. I think he went off. What minute did he go off in that game? I think
it was in the 70s? Or
it was in the mid-70s. Yeah. He finished that game with more kilometers on the clock than Suarez did, who went the 90.
I desperately want him to play because at this stage in a World Cup, you just simply want the best players playing. It's the most
right.
fun. But there is part of me, we haven't seen the best of Luis Suarez yet in this tournament.
No, we haven't, which is amazing considering that he has contributed crucial
yeah.
goals.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to downplay the pass that he made to set up Cavani's first goal, the header. It was perfect.
Yeah.
It was a great ball. But I'm kind of curious, because I know what he has in him. I'm sort of curious if Cavani doesn't play to see if Suarez kind of takes that, okay, get on my back.
Now,
let's go.
There's another school of thought here that it's even harder for France if Cavani doesn't play, because it just increases the extent to which Uruguay will bunker in. They could conceivably play a 4-5-1. Could you imagine that? Five in midfield of the ilk of Uruguay.
Yeah.
with that back four. And just Suarez is the target man. It could be a dull, dull game, baby.
I'd feel so bad for Cavani. He plays for PSG. I mean, if there was one other team in this tournament that he probably was most excited to play against, don't you think it would be France with all his people watching back home? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I think that... I hope he plays. I really, really hope he
plays. So do I, but a hamstring? I don't see it.
What storyline are you most intrigued by heading into the quarterfinals?
Well, obviously, it's coming home is the storyline for everyone, but I'm going to park that one. Here's a quote from Antoine Griezmann, which is just unbelievably delicious. Uruguay will be like Atletico. They will take their time, fall, go to the referee. We will have to get used to that because the match will be boring and they will want to bring us into that. Sorry, you play for Atletico. Like, it was such an honest admission, but also like, hey, buddy, you know. That's the interesting thing for me is this French team, who I don't believe have been awesome, and Griezmann certainly hasn't been awesome yet either. I think, like I said, Argentina were set up for the like of Mbappe to torch them. I think the super goal by Pavard was super, but it's not by any great device of the management.
Right.
I still think this French team is finding itself, and I'm wondering if this is their breakout game, or it's just a crushing, spirit-crushing experience against a team that is absolutely built to stop what they want to do. First of all, for Mbappe, where is he going to run? There's going to be no space, especially if that back four sit off, which we expect them to do. If that midfield is packed, what's Pogba going to do? You know, where is this team going to flourish? So that's my storyline that's interesting. Can the French flair finally emerge in this tournament and down the Uruguayan team?
This tournament's been known for a lot of things, but I went with upsets because I feel like that's been a theme of this tournament that's really been a lot of fun. And we've seen it, of course, with what happened with Spain this past weekend. Just the way, you know, this tournament has opened up with Germany going out in the group stage. Now, the interesting thing about that is it's still very possible that we do wind up. I think we could still wind up with a Final Four without any team being ranked outside of the top 10. I'm trying to think how that would work if England... I don't know. It could still happen, though, where we wind up with somewhat of chalk. But I don't know. I feel like this tournament is just following a different script. Like, whatever we think is going to be the results of these Final Four games, something is going to happen. It just feels like that's been the route that this tournament has taken. So yeah, upsets are one that I want to see if it continues to follow that sort of script. And now, which team has the most pressure on them?
Brazil. Always Brazil. That's all I wrote. It's just a fact.
I went a different route.
Oh?
I went with England.
How?
JJ, they can... They can say it all they want, all right? I mean, they can trick themselves into believing that this is the non-expectation World Cup, that they're just playing for fun.
I know what you're going to say.
They're lying to themselves.
And especially now that the road has opened up.
They're lying to themselves. It's just not true anymore. If they lose to Sweden in the quarterfinals, when they know what's waiting for them in the semifinal will be either Russia or Croatia, whoever it is, they'll be favored to win that game.
For sure.
You can't tell me that there's not pressure on them. Circumstances change expectations. They're not playing Brazil. They're not playing France. They're playing Sweden. There are...
Even though they have a shocking tournament record against them, they have a shocking record against them, period.
Of course. Look, it's not an easy game, but...
But you're right.
But it's not one of the big boys. It's just not.
And the minute Southgate decided to put a weakened team against Belgium, which opened up this road, Colombia would be the first test, and then it was always going to be either Sweden or Switzerland. Basically, not an open road, but an easier path. The minute he did that, he ratcheted up the expectations. I think you're right. That's a good call by you. I still wonder though. You know,
it's because the people are trying to make you think that this is just fun and games right now. That this is all gravy. We never thought we'd be here, but you're here, and you're playing a team that you really have to beat because, like we said, they've been to a semifinal once since '66, and it's been 28 years since that semifinal in 1990. They don't get here very often.
No.
They don't get this chance as often as you would think England would, and it's there. There's pressure, man. I don't care what anybody in that country says, what message they're trying to send out. There's loads and loads of pressure on them.
That's a good shout by you.
Let's see here. All right, which manager has the most to gain with a win?
I've gone with Gareth Southgate. Let me tee it up for you.
Yeah.
If England win to get to the semi-final, he will be the first manager since Italia 90 and Sir Bobby Robson to manage in an English team in the semi-final. Before that, it was Sir Alf Ramsey, who won it in '66. This is the rarefied air he's about to enter. Let's just compare Southgate and Robson for 1 second. Bobby Robson won a UEFA Cup with Ipswich, managed PSV Eindhoven, Porto and Barcelona, worked with Romario Luis Figo and brought Ronaldo, the original Ronaldo, to Europe. He took Newcastle to the Champions League. Southgate, on the other hand, was sacked by Middlesbrough after relegating them to the Championship. This is an elevation in status beyond the beyond. It's beyond what Gareth Southgate could have dreamt of around the time Sam Allardyce was delivering poor advice while being recorded by the Telegraph over a pint of wine. He couldn't have imagined this jump, Andrew, from the 21s to immortality in English football.
It's so true, man. And you know, I keep thinking about something that we talked about on our podcast just 2 days ago. We were talking about the Nasser Chadli goal, and I think I said that one of the great things about the World Cup is that it has the power to make heroes out of minnows. That doesn't just apply to the players. You're right. Southgate is a guy who most England fans and pundits, when he was named as the choice for manager, they described it as lazy, that this was just an easy selection, that he's kind of a placeholder until the next guy's ready. That was the narrative about him coming into this World Cup.
Absolutely.
Look what he's on the verge of doing. You're so right. That's a great call. And for myself, I went with, boy, I feel like we've been talking a lot about Uruguay today, and I'm going to continue that. Oscar Tabárez, Uruguay's manager. They failed to qualify for three of the previous four World Cups, and then he came in 2006 after they did not qualify for that. Since then, not only do they qualify routinely, but look what they do in these World Cups. Semi-finalist, get out of the group in 2014, a group that included England and Italy not going through. Uruguay did. And now he's got them in the quarterfinals. And this is a guy who, when he's talked about, or when great managers are talked about, his name is never, you never hear his name brought
up. You don't.
He went to Uruguay in 2006 in a really tumultuous time, and he completely tore it down. Whatever the model was that they were using, he changed it from the under-15 level, instituted a 4-3-3, which seems funny now because it doesn't really feel like the way that Uruguay play. But he changed everything about the setup, the youth setup in that country, kind of a lot of the things we're talking about that need to happen in the U.S. He did it, and they've been reaping the benefits ever since. And if he's able to beat France, who's considered to be probably the second favorite right now behind Brazil, if he can do that especially if Cavani doesn't play, I think he'll start to get a lot more of the credit that maybe eludes him from some of the mainstream press.
Grant Wall had an ill-advised tweet about Uruguay. He basically said, why don't we discuss how lame it is that they have four stars on their jersey and they've won the World Cup twice, and they also have the two other stars are to do with the Olympics, which was 24 and 28, which was pre-World Cup, before the World Cup existed. As ill advice for one thing, this is a country of 3.5 million people. There's more people where I come from in Ireland, and they constantly punch above their weight. They're incredible. And that's why they've grown on me like a rash.
Yeah.
I hated them at the start. I thought, I can't watch this. Even against Egypt, I thought they were dull. They've grown on me.
Yep. And then last but not least, the obvious one, your predictions for this weekend. It's not really the weekend, the Friday games.
Do you want to go first? You go first.
Yeah, sure. I'll go quickly. I've said all this about Uruguay. I did go with France. I don't think Cavani is going to play. From everything that I've read, it doesn't seem like it's trending in that direction. Maybe Uruguay are trying to send that message on purpose as a smokescreen, but it doesn't seem like he's going to play. That matters. He's had a great tournament. He's probably been their best player. So I am going to go France. I'm going to go Brazil. I will go Croatia over Russia. I think the Russian World Cup run ends. And I do believe that the chance of it coming home will continue. I believe that England will go through over Sweden as well.
Uruguay versus France in Nizhny Novgorod, I'm going with Uruguay. Brazil versus Belgium in Kazan, I'm going with Belgium. England versus Sweden in Samara, I'm going England. And Russia versus Croatia in Sochi, I'm going Croatia.
Wow. Brazil out, France out. You're setting this up for... You're trying to just build... You're doing it with England fans again.
It's coming home.
You're trying to build them up.
Build them up just in Uruguay, innit?
There you go. That's our eight questions for this. By the way, we forgot to talk the other day about... we were at a barbecue over last weekend together with a lot of... It was like 100 people at that thing. But you were a victim of one of the most embarrassing things that can happen to a person.
Oh, I was left hanging by a Super Bowl winning player.
Right. Chris Canty, formerly of the New York Giants, was there. And we know him fairly well. And when he came into the room, you know, he said hi to pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
And then you stood up and put your hand
out.
And
I was at the front of the room. Everyone's
Chris,
behind me.
Yeah, hand out. Chris, how you? And I thought he was staring right at you. I thought he was walking over to say hello to you. And he walked right by you and said hello to the person behind you. It was horrifying.
Oh, it was devastating. That's the worst one that I've ever experienced. And because it happens to everyone at some point in their lives. But that one was just epic.
The worst one that I ever saw like that, I was in college. And a buddy of mine, we were in line at the dining hall getting food. And there's this girl behind the counter, attractive, who was helping serving in the dining hall. She worked there. And she started, my friend like kind of casually knew her. They had a class together or something. So we were right in front of her. And she looks up and she goes, oh, hey. And he's like caught off guard that she would be so friendly. And so he right away starts, oh, hey, how are you?
Oh, no.
And she's answering.
Someone behind him.
It's the person behind
him.
Oh,
good Lord.
JJ, he looked at me. I looked at him. And I was so uncomfortable for him. I had to leave. I left. I was like, whatever's on my plate now, I'm good. I couldn't be around such uncomfortable tension. It was so awful.
But you got to realize that I look up to Chris Canty, both literally and figuratively, because he's enormous.
Yeah.
And I guess he just looked right over me. But I'm a Giants fan. And like, it was crushing. Crushing.
It was
And
was
he did it
to
again
watch.
To me when he left.
Yeah. But you didn't allow it to happen the second
time. I literally called him back.
This is also a party where you nearly blinded a three-year-old child.
Hey, listen, if you're not coming to play hard, go home.
Well, he was home. He happened to live
Should have gone inside. I was lacing punts to you. Oh.
It was fun.
I'll tell you what. Someone said on Twitter, is that Andrew Gundling or Devin Hester?
We're easily confused. I get that. what did you do yesterday, by the way? Was it a beach day for
you? Yeah, beach day. Went out to our good friend and advocate of this show, this podcast, Tom Fitzgerald.
Are lit up right now.
May he live long and prosper.
When you walked in, I said you were obviously outside yesterday.
Yeah, but I was in the
sunburnt.
I was literally in the water so much. It was like, why am I? It washes it off. People, you've got to reapply. And I did, but after the third time, it made no difference.
I hate sunscreen.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
It's helpful, but it's a real nuisance.
You know what, though, as well? My pale Irish skin hadn't seen the sun in, like, months. Yeah. Like, almost a year, so that's what happens.
Let's see. Well, I'll tell you what. I teased it earlier, and I'm so excited about our guest for today because of all of the tweets referenced over the course of the Premier League season, I don't know if there was one account that was referenced more frequently than that of David Priest.
I use it to undermine you.
Right, because anytime I have anything to say, anything about a goalkeeper, you go straight to his Twitter account and said, well, David Priest said this. Well, I'll tell you what, you must feel like we're in the presence of royalty right now, because with us here on the program tonight, former professional goalkeeper, now a football journalist in England, it's David Priest on the line with us now. David, what's up, man?
Thanks for having us on, gents.
Oh, this is awesome. JJ he's like trembling right now. This is incredible.
steady though.
I want to ask you something before we even get into, because there's so much to talk about, both goalkeeping related and just general World Cup action that we've seen so far. But one thing that has really struck me ever since watching the England-Colombia match, and maybe I shouldn't be as surprised by it as I am, but you know, you watch a lot of Premier League and you listen to a lot of EPL podcasts, and you know, everybody's trying to be professional. You know, people aren't trying to show their colors in terms of who they're a fan of and who they support. But watching the reaction of like media, football journalists and pundits in the wake of that game, it was just like all of this emotion came pouring out and people just were like, you know, biases be damned, I'm just going to be a fan of this. I mean, are you feeling that right now as an English person watching this team doing what they're doing?
Most definitely. I think it's this tournament, it's been a bit of a surprise to all of us, and me especially, because it's international football had sort of lost its appeal in the last few years. I think there'd been a lot of apathy about the national team, certainly in England. And I think that Gareth Southgate himself, he alluded to the fact that it wasn't too long ago that his team were being booed off the pitch, and fans in Wembley Stadium were making paper aeroplanes and throw them on the pitch just to amuse themselves. So, you know, we've come a long way in a short space of time, and it's no small thanks to Gareth Southgate and the kind of environment and the atmosphere that he's garnered around the national team.
David, I want to talk about the atmosphere in England in a little bit, but I want to get into specifics, because there's a lad from your part of the country who is performing heroics for England right now, and particularly in the last game, and I'm referring to Jordan Pickford. You did a brilliant piece in the Times breaking down the two saves, the volley from Uribe and then the penalty save itself. Specifically the penalty save, because I got crushed by a few Colombians on this who were trying to tell me that Ospina's save was better than it, which is fine. Ospina's save was a fine save from Jordan Henderson. But why was it such a good stop, his penalty save?
Well, firstly, I think the Colombian fans are probably right about the Ospina save, simply because Jordan Henderson's penalty, it wasn't that bad for a penalty miss. It was probably just inside the post, and he hit it quite well. So, I mean, you still got to give credit to Ospina. But you're right; it's just everything about the save, it's the importance of it, the timing of it, and just the, you know, I've spoken a lot about penalty shootouts and sort of the from a goalkeeping aspect, and especially the psychological aspect of being a goalkeeper in a penalty shootout, and just regardless of the technical detail around it as well, it just seemed it was the one penalty out of the five of them that he was so sure of where it was going. And of course, we now know that he wrote down sort of a little bit of research on the back of his water bottle he took behind the goal. So he'd already made his mind up where he was going to go, regardless of what the penalty taker did. So it was just everything about it, and also that we go back to the Tunisia game when he conceded a penalty in that game, and a lot of people thought that because he went the right way and he wasn't too far away from getting the penalty, he came under a little bit of criticism, a little bit of nitpicking, that he didn't save it. And I can see why, because he decided to go the right way, but from a technical point of view, he didn't really get a good step into his dive, so he didn't get the cover the same amount of distance that he would do usually. And everything was different about this one. He was fully committed to the dive. Technically, it was great because he was diving forwards, stepping into the dive. And not only that, it was great from my perspective, because it was, you know, because of the goal he conceded against Belgium where he used his top hand. Mm. It was that same top hand that that people criticise him for using that made the savings. If it wasn't for his top hands, you know, if he tried to use his right hand, he wouldn't have been able to save that shot. So it was just everything about it was just fantastic from my perspective.
David, you mentioned the preparation there. It's 20 years ago, and I remember watching ITV when England went out on penalties to Argentina, and Glenn Hoddle said afterwards in a press conference that penalties are a lottery. How frustrating is it as an England fan to think of the lack of preparation in years gone by, and now we've got this team that has been preparing for months for this, and the rewards have come? How frustrating is it for all those lost tournaments?
It's hugely frustrating, simply because as a nation, we've bought into that sort of theory about it. It wasn't only him, it was Sven-Göran Eriksson. He also said, you know, that because you can't recreate that moment, the atmosphere, the tension, the fatigue in the legs, the adrenaline. It is very difficult, but at the same time, you can do everything within that you're capable of, everything that's possible, other than that. So, you know, there's little things that you can do. From a goalkeeper perspective, there's little tricks that you can do, and psychologically, it's a huge battle between you and the taker. And certainly, you can't make sure that you're going to save every penalty, but you can play percentages, and even if just shifting it in your favour by a couple of percent, something's worth doing in that case. And it's great to see that you got someone on board like Gareth Southgate, who I was the same as everyone else, who, you know, I thought was just a beige appointment. It was an easy choice. But in hindsight now, what it's done is he's part of a big jigsaw now. There was Dan Ashworth when he was brought in. He had a team around him. He had this idea of changing the DNA of English football. And it wasn't anything to do with tactics. It wasn't anything to do with technical. A lot of it was psychological and the way we approach the game and the way we think about football. And because he's been able to bring Gareth on board, who's very much of that mindset as well, there's been no convincing, or there's been no figurehead that they've had to sort of tiptoe around. He's been part of that, and it's been able to, for this DNA, this new era of football, it's been able to flourish in a short space of time. So all that hard work that's gone into it previously under different managers, it's been able to sort of come to a head now. And regardless of what happened against Colombia, regardless of the result, we were on the right path. It didn't matter what was going to happen. There was changes that you could see in the players. You could see the way they played. And ultimately, now that they've won, you can see now that they're definitely on the right path. Things are definitely changing.
Former goalkeeper David Priest joining us here on Caught Offside. David, I wanted to ask you about this. When I found out you were coming on, there was a little bit of controversy around the Croatia-Denmark shootout with keepers coming off their line prematurely. Can you take us down onto the pitch with this? I mean, what are referees telling these guys beforehand? Is there like some sort of agreement where as long as it's not overly egregious, they're going to let it slide?
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, in extreme cases, you know, you'll get goalkeepers who are two steps off the line, and obviously it's going to be pulled back for that extreme. But from my perspective, I keep saying this a lot because it's from a goalkeeper's perspective, but technically you're coached to dive forward. You don't dive laterally along the line.
Right.
You need to dive forward to meet the ball, meet the flight of the ball, cut the angle off so you cover a greater area behind you. And it's just natural for you to step into a dive. Now, you know, I've heard some people say that it's cheating. Well, if it's cheating, then the referee, the linesman, the officials, VAR, they have to clamp down it if they see it that way. But the odds are stacked so much in the penalty taker's favour. You know, for I think it's 23% of penalties are either saved or missed. So it's heavily weighed in the favour of the taker. So it's, you know, little things like that. Yeah, I think they can let it slide. Like I said, it's just something that goalkeepers are coached to do.
David, looking ahead to Saturday and the clash with Sweden, do you worry about the amount of chances this England team is creating?
Well, apart from the first game, I think, you know, the first 45 minutes, we probably created more chances than we have in the rest of the tournament.
Yeah.
We started off well, and you can put that down to the way the teams play against us. Panama were always going to defend very deep. I think Tunisia in times were maybe not naive, but they played a pretty good pressing game. That's their game. They're aggressive. And that was probably their downfall, and we were able to create chances. It wasn't until they were a little bit more cagey in the second half that they started to see the results of that. But yeah, you can't take much from the Belgium game. It was always going to be a disjointed performance because of all the changes. And again, the Colombia game was, you know, high tension, and despite not creating a lot of chances, you know, you look at the other end of the scale, and Jordan Pickford, until that last minute, the last couple of minutes when Uribe's took that speculative effort from a long way out, he hasn't been troubled in the game. He hasn't been put under pressure, and so you can see that. You can see that's a worry that they're not, they're not creating a lot of chances. But at the same time, it's something that's maybe been foreseen, because we've concentrated so much on set pieces, we've probably thought, well, maybe that's our game. That's the way it's going to pan out. And if we can't do that, if we can't open teams, if teams defend deep against us, then we've got a plan B. We've got something else in there, in our back pocket. So it's not too much of a worry for me, actually. And I think you always find against a better size, when you come up against better quality size, they're going to come out and attack you. They're not going to be happy to sit back in. Sweden might be a different proposition altogether, because they're very good defensively. That's their game. But like I said, you know, in my experience, whenever you play against superior sides, you always knew that you were going to get more of a chance to play football and have a little bit more of the ball. So from that perspective, no. But I just think the Sweden game's going to, perhaps will be a bit of a war of attrition, and it might be a bit, it might sound a bit strange that the game be won in both boxes, but that's where it's going to be played, and it's definitely going to be down to set pieces.
David, one more from me. This tournament was funny with respect to England, in that this was supposed to be the tournament with no expectations, where everybody was going to take a step back and let this young group gel together, and then maybe the next European Championships or the next World Cup, that would be the one where the expectations would return. Since then, the side of the bracket they wound up on, Spain going out, England eliminating Colombia, it's all opened up for them. Have the expectations just come rushing back in? I mean, bring us over to how people in England are feeling right now about where this team is at.
Do you know, we get a lot of criticism, and J&J will back this up as well, you know, from Ireland, Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland, whenever there's a tournament, because there's all this hype and we're going to win the tournament. That has died down. But what it's being replaced by now is, you'll hear people, you know, if you see people tweeting, it's coming home, or they start seeing it, it's coming home. We're singing that, but at the same time, if it's not coming home now, there won't be the big sort of inquest afterwards. There won't be a sort of any fingers pointed anywhere, because people can see beyond that. They can see beyond the results, and they can see the performance. And the big thing about this squad of players is that they're all very likeable players. There isn't a sort of irritable character that some fans don't like.
Terry Butcher.
They all come across as really wholesome. And like I said, you're willing them to do well rather than expecting them to do well. You're really willing them on, and you want to be positive to drive them on. And like I said, if they don't do well, there's an acceptance, because you feel that they're an honest bunch, which goes against the narrative about young footballers who are paid all this money and they don't care about the game. You know, these players are younger than their golden generation counterparts were 10 years ago, but and they're probably being paid more the same age that they were. But there's a difference about them. There's an honesty, and I think people appreciate that. And so, like I said, we think football's coming home. We'll say it's coming home, but you know, if they don't come home like a, I don't know, like an expectant wife expects his husband to come home after a few beers, after two beers. I mean, if he comes home after five, she's not going to be angry.
David, one final one from me. It's been a tumultuous 2 years in England, socially and politically. And I was in England for Euro 96. And, you know, me being an Irish man coming from the part of the country that I did, I saw the windows draped in St. George's flags, but it was happy, it was friendly, there was a buzz. I'll never forget that summer, and I got behind the team as a 14-year-old. Do you feel there's a unifying effect going on right now with this tournament?
That is a tough question because, you know, like you said, we've still got lots going on in the background politically. And there was a bit of a complaint. People were like kind of upset and I was a little bit sad that there wasn't all these flags everywhere. People didn't have the flags on their cars or in the back windows of the cars and on the grills of the cars because it used to be like that. And I think the feeling is that, you know, the George Cross was, it's kind of been hijacked a little bit by sort of, by the right wing, also people with right wing politics. And it's become a little bit of a touchy subject, you know. So it's, I think everyone, you know, it is unifying, but at the same time, like you've said, there's something there in the background that it's not exactly the same feeling. Maybe it's just because I'm older and a little bit more cynical. And
yeah,
in '96 when I was 20 years old, I was a little bit more innocent about things. But it's true that it's just not the same. And there's no doubt that the country's definitely divided, and something happens either way, whether we leave Europe or we stay in Europe, it's always going to be the same. We're still going to be in limbo, and it's a strange feeling.
It'll be even stranger when we have Sir Raheem Sterling and the Sun have to report about that.
Oh, do you know what? It's like the other night about, you know, he didn't come under too much criticism there, John Pickford. But I was just it went perfectly for him in my eyes. I was over the moon for him, and it's the same with Raheem, because I've interviewed him a couple of times a few years ago when he was still a teenager, and it was amazing that he was just a kid. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm sitting there talking to him now, and I was supposed to be talking to this professional footballer, and he was a baby. You know, he's sitting there telling me that he's a believer. Do you know what I mean? It was the first one was about fashion for Top Man at a shop over here, and this is what's your fashion? So I'm a bit of a skater boy. I know, like how Justin Bieber dresses, and I mean it's he's built up as some sort of, like, I don't know, some sort of evil gangster or something like that. Yep. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous, really. And anybody in the press, it's smart, because most of the press who know him for what he is. He was just a nice lad. And the rest of that's the back page press, and the front page press they just seem to go after him unfairly. And I think it's nice that a lot of people in England have got his back.
Yeah.
There'll still be people who disagree with him being in the side and say that maybe Ruben Loftus-Cheek should be playing Marcus Rashford should be playing. But at the same time, there's been a lot of love for him, and that's been nice to see.
Well, good stuff, man. I know it's late there. We appreciate you taking some time. England have been fascinating throughout, so we wanted to talk to you about that. And, of course, penalties play such a prevalent role in goalkeeping down the stretch. So it was great getting you on, getting a chance to talk. Thanks, man.
Anytime, guys. Cheers.
Our thanks to David Preece. He said something. I was talking about it earlier when I said that England are the team that I believe had the most pressure on them, because it's secret pressure, but we all know that it's there. And yeah. David said if it doesn't come home, there will be no inquest after.
There won't.
Now, look, I buy that. None of these guys are going to be vilified.
There will be an inquest if they go out to Sweden.
But yes.
Yeah, and that's the game.
And look, when we say inquest, no one's getting fired. Gareth Southgate is not losing his job. I think he's already done enough to secure that, certainly through the European Championship.
And he can't get them relegated.
But don't be confused. No, but don't be confused by this. It will be viewed by everyone around the globe as a massive missed opportunity. There's no question
100%,
about it.
100%. But if
the tone will change of English fans very quickly if they lose to Sweden.
If he leads them out in a semi-final against Croatia, whatever happens, happens. They cannot lose to Sweden because
right.
The tone will change. That's the tone changer for me, that game.
Yeah, and you say that about Croatia. It'll be the same message going into that. Croatia are good, but people in England especially will believe we should be beating Croatia.
Yeah,
and they're not wrong.
No,
they're not wrong for thinking that. But our thanks to David Preece. We've wanted to have him on for quite some time. We reached out and bang. Got him right on.
Read his stuff in the Times.
Yeah, he's really good. Mailbag, you said you got a big one over there. I'm nervous.
CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com. Starting off with Daniel Farmer. G'day, guys, all the way down from down under in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a diehard Liverpool fan, and I've been listening to the pod for 3 years now. Never missed a pod.
Wow. Oh, love God. You guys and what you do. By far my favourite podcast. JJ, your red card to the American soccer fans about not making the World Cup was sensational. Best thing I've heard. Keep up the good work. You bloody legends. Cheers. So to that I reply, I have an Australian reply ready for you.
You little ripper! Thanks, lads.
You ripper.
What's that from?
Some Australian film.
Oh.
But I used to watch Australian soaps all the time, Neighbours and Home and Away.
Who are you?
They're just the biggest soaps in Ireland for my whole life were Australian ones.
Really?
Yeah, massive. Huge. It's the home of soap operas.
Never knew that.
Joshua Taboga emailed to say he liked my poem on Messi and that Andrew is an uncultured Philistine.
Look, I read Shel Silverstein with the best of them, all right?
Marcel Acevedo is very proud of Uruguay. I couldn't be prouder of what this little nation of 3.5 million people continues to achieve on the world stage. I've been following the team since I can remember. I'm 28. My parents came to the US from Uruguay in 1977. We visited Uruguay yearly every summer to see the rest of the family, all aunts, uncles, cousins, are still there. I have a special bond with Uruguay. Although my dad and I share all the same teams in the NHL, NBA and NFL, Uruguay has always been the team we were most passionate about. I even took him as a Father's Day gift to see them for the first time live at Lincoln Financial Field 2 years ago at the Copa Centenario. He's 72 now and I'll never forget him telling me how he couldn't believe that he was seeing Uruguay play in person for the first time in his life with his son in the United States.
Oh, wow.
They continue to give me these incredible special moments and I get to share them with my father in this World Cup. Treasure it. Michael McMahon, I'm not trying to whine unnecessarily, only a tiny bit, I guess, because I'm a fan of Spain. But why isn't anyone talking about the Russia players being implicated in the state doping scandal? Michael goes on to say that plenty of people are talking about it. Henry Bushnell in Yahoo Sports, Reuters, The Independent, very good piece by Jack Pitbrook on that.
And if you were on Twitter during the game, everyone.
Yeah. I can't help but wonder if this team is defying expectation based on their own grit and determination or is benefiting from more FIFA corruption. Can you weigh in on this? Look, we don't know what they're benefiting from right now. They have a shady past going back to the 2014 World Cup and we know about state-sponsored doping in Russia. So,
well, yeah, that's the thing. Unfortunately for them, they've kind of lost all benefit of the doubt.
Which is gone.
Which is sad. It's kind of like baseball now. When a guy hits 60 home runs or 55 home runs and he hadn't done it before, immediately suspicion goes up. So it becomes hard to enjoy what they're doing. So I do understand that a little bit with Russia. But by the same token, wouldn't you think, JJ, that of every nation in this tournament, there's not a bigger microscope from that perspective?
Yeah, but
than the one that's on them?
There's a microscope on them and then you see their running stats and you're like, incredible, just incredible. Now, look, I think organisation has been the key. I actually don't think it's anything else. Look at the way they were organised against Spain. Could I set up a team to play like that? Yeah, I could. It's not that hard what they've done. They've just been solid and stoic and they've waited games out.
That's the thing I was going to say, because I know you had the stats earlier, but I'd be curious to see those stats against Spain. How much running did they do? They kind of were set up in the final third of the field and never really left it.
Yep, we got to see it though.
Yeah.
Chris Greenier, hey guys, love the pod, keep up the great work. I'm watching the matches on Sunday and then going through social media. I'm seeing so many people complain about matches coming down to penalties. I know it's not the best way to determine a winner, but my question is what should be done if the game is tied after extra time? Keep playing until every player falls down from exhaustion. Maybe after extra time we have a golden goal situation. It just gets annoying because there really isn't a way that will satisfy everyone. Anyway, thanks for reading my email. Enjoy listening to you guys, and JJ is right about VAR. I would like to see the golden goal given another shot in extra time. I genuinely would. The game has opened out both in the Champions League and internationally. There is more offense definitely being played. Let's go for that again, because if it means we don't go to penalties, it's a fairer way.
Yeah, I'm fine. I've always said I like golden goal also. One thing I've found with penalties is that, and I'm not talking about this guy who sent this email, but by and large, people who swoop in to watch the World Cup, they don't like that sometimes games are decided that way, and they're the ones that want to change it, and then the World Cup ends and they go back to whatever. Like, I find that it's people who don't really like the sport that want to change it. Well, who are you?
Yeah.
You're not watching, you're not following this, so you want to change this game that we all seem to really enjoy?
You say what you want about penalties, nothing builds tension and excitement like them.
It's incredibly, look, I don't love deciding games that way either. You don't always feel like the best team is going to win, but you're right. I don't know what a better alternative is. The only thing I can think, what do you think of what the NHL does, not in the postseason, but in the regular season, where in overtime they go, instead of 5-on-5, they go down to 3-on-3.
Yeah.
It just opens the ice up, and it feels like breakaway, like a lot of action is happening.
I would experiment with it.
What if they went down to like 9-a-side or something like that, or 8-a-side?
You can, I mean, I can still build up a pretty solid back line. That's not good. That's just going to be negative. I don't They'd need to experiment with it. Yeah. I mean, maybe we go back to MLS penalties from 1996.
Nah.
Nathaniel Koloff, a very simple one from Nathaniel. I would still rather be Germany and have lost 2-0 to South Korea than lose to this Russian team. Really? Verdan Kitalich reckons we are like Chris Berman and Tom Jackson. We'll be like them in 30 years' time. All right.
And who's who? I'm very curious.
I mean, I'm just going to get exponentially fatter, so I'm going to be Berman.
Tom Jackson wasn't exactly a stick figure.
I can't remember Jackson.
Okay.
And he also compares Cliff Kingsbury to Lionel Messi. Yep. So that happened.
Did he explain?
He did. Do you want me to go into it?
Kinda.
After watching Argentina during this tournament, I've developed the theory that Lionel Messi is Cliff Kingsbury. Faultless at the club level, within his system, surrounded by the best players on the planet, he is brilliant. But take him and put him on an average Argentina squad, and he all of a sudden looks very mortal. 756 minutes of knockout play in the World Cups with exactly zero goals worth of mortal.
I mean,
is that even true?
Cliff Kingsbury was hardly... Well, whatever. Cliff Kingsbury was hardly at Texas Tech what Messi is at Barcelona. Like, no one said Cliff Kingsbury is the greatest quarterback in college football history.
But, yeah,
I get what he's saying about being a system guy, but
I don't think it works.
But you know what? I give him full marks for creativity, because that is pretty good.
Jared McLachlan. I am Jared and a fan all the way from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Nice.
Watching the England game and just wondering, are they really going to knight good old Gareth when England wins this World Cup? I mean, be honest. Yes, in a few years' time they will.
Oh my God, the whole team will receive knighthood.
Yeah.
By the way, he's from Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Props to the Kentucky Fried Chicken in South Africa, which came out with just a great commercial mocking players who dive. Specifically, it seemed like it was more aimed at Neymar.
Yeah, this guy goes for a dive and rolls straight out the stadium.
All the way to a Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yes, I do believe that they're going to win this, as much as I hate to admit it. I am typing this 24 minutes into the first half of the England-Columbia game, but somehow I know I will get my heartbroken by the end of this game. Come to the point in question, who do you think they're going to face in the final?
Brazil.
Probably.
You have Brazil losing to Belgium. Come on. Have you no respect for the predictions?
Yeah, but I wasn't fully in on that one.
All right.
I actually think, yeah, okay, Belgium then.
Nothing you say can be taken seriously.
Let me just see. Andrew Zwillinger. JJ, doesn't England breaking through their penalty jinx simply mean that it'll be much more hilarious when they ultimately bottle it against a very limited Sweden side? Yep, that's true. Also, Andrew becoming an England supporter is the most gundling thing ever. He probably prefers the lyrics to God Save the Queen over My Country Tis of Thee.
Didn't I literally texted you during the game?
Yeah. Paul Burke.
By the way, that's not a permanent thing. It's just people ask you in this tournament, who are you getting behind? And it just kind of organically happened. The tournament will end. I don't have to explain myself. I'm an American fan, and anybody that listens to this would never doubt that.
Benedict Gundling.
Don't you ever say that.
Paul Burkett agrees with you that Japan did the right thing on the final corner v. Belgium because Japan knew they couldn't win an extra time.
They had no shot.
Which, I mean, so obviously knowing you can't win an extra time means that you give up
that
all.
You try to win at the end of regular time is what it means.
So you float in a corner.
Are you about done here? And this is a mailbag to end all mailbags.
No, this is the final one, and it's worthy from Kyle Schultz, who did the Lord's work with this.
Nice.
Love the show and great work on the World Cup coverage. I listened to all of your group stage previews and took a look at what your predictions were for each group. I did the same with the podcast done by Robbie Earle and Robbie Musto of NBC Sports.
I'm actually nervous right now.
And the pre-World Cup SPI predictions, just to see how everyone's predictions compared. I know we are now in the quarterfinals, but felt it would be fun to look at the comparisons. Below are the results. Robbie Earle, 81.3% correct. So that's 13 out of 16 predictions went through. Robbie Musto, 81.3% correct. 13 out of 16 went through. JJ, 68.8% correct. 11 out of 16 went through.
Like
Andrew, 68.8% correct. 11 out of 16 went through. The SBI, 87.5% correct, 14 out of 16 went through. Also, JJ predicted that Neymar would be top scorer in the tournament. He still may well. Well, I don't. He probably won't be now, but it kind of looked like it.
Harry Kane,
well. And Andrew went with Gabriel Jesus. As of right now, Harry Kane has the most goals with 6, Neymar has 2, and Jesus has 0.
Yeah.
Obviously, trying to predict outcomes of the World Cup is very difficult, but just thought it would be fun to see how everyone's predictions went. Again, love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Kyle, for
taking... That's great work by him.
It was
him.
A really good work.
Yeah.
We should hire him.
I appreciate that very much. Hey, that was a great mailbag. Really
Thank
enjoyed
you.
It. At CO Soccer Pod on Twitter. And remember your iTunes reviews. Leave us an iTunes review with your favorite quarterfinal, World Cup quarterfinal memory. We'll try to find the highlight of some of the best ones, and we'll play them on our next podcast. I know we're getting to the end here, so you probably thought you had escaped this. But
oh.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Ready?
A unique torture. Go on.
Quarterfinal trivia. When he scored last weekend against Argentina, Kylian Mbappe became the first teenager to score in the knockout round of a World Cup since this guy.
Teenager.
To score in the knockout stage of a World Cup.
Michael Owen versus Argentina.
No! Julian Green against Belgium!
Oh, I forgot about, just like everybody else, I too forgot about Julian Green.
That was a moment, though. Came right in off the bench, and that was really something.
Well, I'm glad he was actually used, because Julian Green smacked of Walcott in 2006 when Sven brought him and never played him. I was glad Jürgen actually had the cojones to play him.
When Brazil, here's your next one. When Brazil play Belgium tomorrow, it will be Brazil's 109th World Cup match, tying this country for the most games played in the World Cup all time.
Most. Italy.
No, Germany.
Oh,
I would have thought that was your easy one.
No, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know.
Okay.
Italy should be up there, too.
All right. Let's see.
Here Whatever. These are stupid.
I love when you get angry.
These
you really
are
angry.
Stupid. It's just
You're
nonsense.
So You're so
Guesswork.
Yeah, come on, get angry. Use that. Use that for this last one.
Shut up.
Here we go. Final one. There have been 9 game-winning goals at this World Cup scored in the 90th minute or later. That is a record. One of them was an own goal by Morocco against Iran, so we'll take that out. Can you name just 3 others from this World
90th
Cup?
Minute goals.
Or later, yeah.
Or later. The Ronaldo one against Spain.
No. Game winning. That was a tying goal.
Oh, it was a game winner.
Not off to a great start.
So our friend Nasser Chadli.
That's one.
That was a winner. What were the other winners? Our friend... Also, our little man, Jedrin Shaqiri.
Against Serbia, that's
Stout
another.
Little man.
Yep.
What's another one?
I'd say there's 2 more that you should definitely get.
Oh, and Harry Kane against Tunisia.
That's right. Would have also accepted Philip Coutinho against Costa Rica, Toni Kroos against Sweden.
I'll tell you something. The Costa Rica bashers out there have to realize Brazil scored both their goals after the 90 minutes.
Yeah. Salem Al-Dasari against Egypt. Even Perisic against Iceland. Kim Jong-gwan for South Korea against Germany. Remember,
yeah.
Both of those were in stoppage
time. Those aren't game winners,
and
though.
Well, yes, it was. South Korea beat Germany 2-0, but the initial one...
Oh, was the first one that late?
Yeah.
Wow, well.
And you said Chadli versus Japan. So you did get that. So there you go. I saw one tweet saying that as much as you hate the trivia, this person loves it and actually wants it to be double in length.
Oh my God.
Maybe we'll just do an entire podcast when this is all over. Just a blowout.
Consider you never give me an indication as to what these will be about. I do pretty well with no prep.
I think you should have gotten Julian Green.
Red card.
I should have, but like most managers in his career, I've forgotten about him too.
I'm going to go first here. JJ, I give my red card to Radamel Falcao.
How dare you?
Well, I dare. Here's what he had to say about Mark Geiger's refereeing in Tuesday's loss.
Oh my God, this is a double Geiger red pod. I don't have the same thing.
Yours is a little bit different.
God, the whole of South America is against him.
Falcao said this: the referee disturbed us a lot. In the 50-50 plays, he always made the calls in favor of England. He didn't act with the same criteria for both teams. When in doubt, he always went to the England side. I found it peculiar that they put an American referee in this instance. To tell you the truth, the process leaves a lot of doubts. 2 things. For one, what I would say to Falcao is this. Geiger's most egregious decision of that match was one that probably went in your favor.
Benefited when he
elected to not give Barrios what seemed to be an obvious red card for headbutting
or
Jordan
not even,
Henderson.
He never even asked to consult with VAR or to take a better look at it, because if he had...
And for as physical as Colombia were, I mean, for not one player to see a second yellow, they had 6 yellow cards in this game. I don't know. Yes, maybe there were some calls that went England's way, but when you're playing such a physical style as the Colombians were, you heard John Stones say earlier today that it was the dirtiest team he had ever played against. You lose the benefit of the doubt at a certain point.
And he played for Barnsley down in the championship. Can you imagine?
Yeah. He said for everything I'm paraphrasing Stones, but he said for everything that you saw on camera, it was twice that.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I understand Falcao, you know, he's upset, he's emotional, but I just don't know, I just don't think it's true what he's saying. I think he's just wrong. And look, the part about assigning an American referee...
that's just cheap.
Well, I wasn't sure how to read into that because when I read the article, it seemed to... I felt like the implication was more about the fact, not that Americans don't know anything about soccer, but rather that an American referee will side with England. And I just... I don't know that to be true. Is he saying that because we're both English-speaking countries?
Probably.
What would people be saying about me if I came on this podcast and said that, you know, obviously an Argentinian referee would favor Spain? I mean, like...
They'd consider you xenophobic.
Yeah. But so is it okay now for Falcao to say it? Look, he's speaking out of pure emotion after one of the most difficult losses of his life. So I'm not going to get on him too much, but I will give him my red card.
My red card is along a similar line, and it's Diego Maradona, who's forgetting who's buttering his bread. He weighed in on England versus Colombia as well. This was from RTE. Maradona, a World Cup winner in 86, was also angry with that decision, Geiger's decisions, and Geiger's performance, calling the result a monumental robbery, which is just such hyperbole. In an interview with Venezuelan television channel Telesur, Maradona, who is understood to receive $10,000 US dollars per game from FIFA as part of its Legends Ambassador program, also said that FIFA's referees committee chairman Pierluigi Collina should apologize to the Colombian people because Geiger knows a lot about baseball but has no idea about football.
Do we know that he knows a lot about baseball?
Well, probably. FIFA responded... FIFA responded to Maradona's comments with a statement that it said strongly rebukes the criticism of the performance of the match officials when it considers to have been positive in a tough and highly emotional match. Maradona, curiously, not really, later issued an apology on Instagram. Hmm. I said a couple of things and I admit some of them are unacceptable. My apologies to FIFA, who pay me lots of money to watch games, and its president. As much as I may sometimes have opinions contrary to some arbitration decisions, I have absolute respect for the work. Not easy that the institution and the referees do. No, you don't.
No, you
FIFA
don't.
Told you we're going to cut the gravy train off and the wine at the games if you don't stop the nonsense. That's what happened there. By the way, the general view of Geiger's performance from outside of these shores has not been kind. From people outside of Maradona and Falcao. So there we go.
It's because he's American and you know it.
Caught Offside's Man of the Match.
Oh, let's see. Speaking of Americans, I went with my Man of the Match as some Men of the Match. Young Americans in Germany. That's right. The Bundesliga's official website released their list of the Wunderkid 11.
Wunderkind.
Heading into this coming season, the best young players in the league. 4 of the 11 are Americans. You think you can name them?
Coming into next season?
Yeah.
Josh Sargent.
He's one.
Christian Pulisic.
He's obviously one.
Weston McKennie.
Yeah. You'll never get the last one. Don't even try.
No, I will. It's probably the kid at Schalke.
No.
Hadji Wright.
No.
Okay.
JJ, it's Jonathan Klinsmann. What are you making that noise for?
Really?
Yeah.
Is he improved that much?
I guess so.
Guess so. All right.
So how about that? 4 of the 11. I mean, we're in a time looking for promising signs. I'd say that is certainly one of them. By the way, I guess this all would prompt one of these, which we haven't had in quite some time.
It's time for Boy Wonder Why, Christian Pulisic. Oh, that boy really is special.
JJ, I saw a little report earlier today.
Yeah, widely disseminated.
That Christian Pulisic could be heading to Spurs.
Well, the Tottenham Hotspurs FC have made a bid of just shy of 60 million for the kid.
Yeah, I saw that report, and I was on Twitter. So NBC Sports, I think, was the first one that I saw that tweeted it. And I opened my mouth to speak, and oddly enough, Steve McManaman had overtaken my vocal cords, and all that could come out was this.
Oh, my God!
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's great. Like, it's exciting because he's an exciting player. If I'm a Spurs fan, I'm pumped. But at the same time, I stop and I think, where's he going to even play?
Yeah, I wonder that too. Like, I wonder if they...
And I don't want him going if he's not going to start. And you would presume he would start at that money. So
Of course he would. But
somebody else loses out that's equally talented.
I wonder if they know something that we don't. There's been some talk about a lot of big clubs being in on Christian Eriksen. If there could be a spot in the midfield that opens up.
That would be huge weight on his shoulders to come in and take the mantle of Christian Eriksen,
Andrew. It wouldn't just be him. I mean, the burden would be shifted to a lot of guys. Dele Alli would have to pick up the slack.
I would imagine Son, might make way. They can't give up Eriksen.
Well, we'll see. Look, we talk about transfer rumors all the time. They're largely garbage.
Yeah.
But because this is
Kicker had
my favorite American player and my favorite club team combined into one glorious rumor, it felt like it had to be mentioned. What do you have?
My man of the match is the interneters, the millennials who create the memeology. The internet has been doing some great work lately, particularly as some clever memeologists have seized upon "It's Coming Home" in the wake of renewed optimism surrounding England's chances of at least getting to a World Cup final. "Football's Coming Home" was obviously the official England song of Euro 96 when England hosted the tournament and got to the semi-final. Well, now some of cinema and TV's most memorable moments are being rewritten to include the excitement that it is indeed coming home. So let me give you an example of this. Remember the scene from The Shawshank Redemption where Andy Dufresne locks himself in the warden's office and blasts out operatic music? Well, that one's been changed now to the scene remains as it is, and what comes across the speakers in the prison yard? It's coming home. Or when Neo stops the bullets in The Matrix, this is what happens.
What is he doing?
He's beginning to believe.
That one is particularly clever. So Neo's been shot at by...
It might be the most famous scene of the movie.
So he stops the bullets.
Yeah.
But in this one, they've rejigged it to say unrealistic expectations is one bullet. The other bullet is Spain.
Right.
You know, the other bullet is 30 years of hurt or something like that. And he just picks them off.
Yeah.
And then that happens. Or what about that amazing scene from Friends when the cheeky monkey, Marcel, takes the CD and puts it on?
Marcel, where are you going with that disc? You are not putting that on again. Marcel, okay, if you press that button, you are in very, very big trouble.
It's coming home, it's coming home. Football's coming home, it's coming home. It's coming home, it's coming home.
Beautiful.
So there's so many things like that I'm really enjoying. And also celebrities just going crazy. You don't need to know that Ross Kemp is one of the most famous TV soap opera actors in England to find this unbelievably amazing. His reaction when at full time after the penalties, when England finally won penalties, he is inexplicably shirtless in his kitchen and he does this video.
You will never know what that means to me. That is everything. Everything. We love you, boys. We love you.
That is great. I saw also a video of Jordan Pickford's dad, apparently.
Going nuts.
Yeah.
My boy's a hero, he was shouting, which was something special.
That's pretty, the realization of that hitting you was... it's incredible.
Yep, so there's a lot of good things happening on the internet. You should just type in the search, It's Coming Home. And also, Ross Kemp, just Google that. I watched that 40 times today.
You know what made me start to believe the whole It's Coming Home thing? The Jules Rimet Trophy actually released a song of her own. Or its own, his own.
Seriously?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you heard the Trophy release this song.
I'm coming home.
It really made a believer out of me and many others.
That's crazy. It's beautiful voice home. Jules Rimet Trophy has.
The real Jules Rimet is a man, but in trophy form, it's female.
Juliet Rimet.
Yeah. So there you go. What a show.
Gone way over, my friend.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a World Cup. We've just given up.
Time is a flat circle.
We've completely given up. This was fun, though. And David Priest, very cool of him to join us. It was late over in England, but they're not sleeping over there right now.
No.
I mean, every day is just a party.
Do we go to an English bar on Saturday morning?
I will be in another part of the Northeast. Okay. I will not be around. I'll be in the Jersey Shore.
Would it be safe for me to do such a thing?
Well, which JJ is showing up? The one on this podcast who pretends to hate England or the one when the mics are turned off, who's been cheering them on and loving them?
Hmm.
You're not even sure.
Not sure. I don't know. I might be all...
I think you should. You're not that guy who's going to go make trouble.
No, but I'll be into the game, and then someone might sing, "Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves."
And you will get offended very quickly.
And I will storm out.
Because you are that guy who loves to make fun of others, but the second it comes back to you, you turtle up, and you get very... You put up this front, this tough front. You can be very difficult. You really can.
I'm a strange guy. I'm a complex guy. I'm the rust coal of this podcast.
Well, hey, this was very fun. Let this play. We're all believers now, aren't we?
By the way, we're part of the problem.
Hey, to you I say,
take you later, football.
I'll see you later, bud.
Enjoy the football.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.